ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It is Wednesday, the 1st of May. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, Australia has had success with public health campaigns to save thousands of lives. Can the same techniques be used to reduce domestic violence? And outback tennis, coaches take to the road in remote New South Wales, bringing the joy of the game to young people.
It's a great thing in every respect, from mental health to socially connecting and community and fun and coordination, and you're exercising and without even feeling like you're breaking a sweat, you're just having that much fun.
First today, the federal government will spend more than $925 million over the next 5 years to provide financial assistance to help victim survivors flee violent relationships. Under the plan, people escaping abusive situations will be able to access $5,000 payments. The funding will be contained in next fortnight's budget. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has made the announcement after a national cabinet meeting in Sydney a short time ago. For more on this, our political reporter Evelyn Manfield joins me now. Evelyn, good afternoon. Can you take us through what the Prime Minister has announced?
Sally, well, after Anthony Albanese met with the chief ministers and the premiers, he's come out and announced that $925 million will be put towards these measures, and that'll be in the budget in 2 weeks' time and will be spent over 5 years. So this will help to permanently establish the Leaving Violence program. Now, that program helps people escaping violence, which we know is so often women and children, to receive financial support, safety assessments and referrals to support pathways. So those eligible, as you mentioned, will receive up to $5,000 in support. There was also a lot of reference when the Prime Minister spoke to how they can best help combat violence against women in the online environment as well. So the Prime Minister announced a range of measures to help combat what he called toxic and male extremist views about women online. He said that was something that both premiers and parents that he'd spoken to had raised with him. So he said the government would introduce legislation to ban the creation and distribution of deepfake pornography and the sharing of sexually explicit material using technology like artificial intelligence. He said that'll be subject to serious criminal penalties. He also announced a new phase of the Stop It at the Start campaign. So that will launch in mid-June and will run until mid-2025. And this will include an online campaign that'll challenge some of those materials that are being viewed online. Here's him speaking earlier.
We know that when a woman is killed by a violent partner, too often some people will say, why didn't she leave? And it's because of there not being options, which is why it is very important that we don't put people in the situation where they can't afford to leave.
That's the Prime Minister there speaking a short time ago. Evelyn, what other measures have come out of today's National Cabinet meeting?
We also heard from Communications Minister Michelle Rowland because, as I mentioned, there was a lot of reference to this sort of imagery or content that's been online. So Minister Rowland said that the Australian government will also commit $6.5 million in the May budget for a pilot of age verification technologies. And she says this will help to better protect children online and reduce their exposure to harmful content. She says that digital platforms or social media platforms as well really need to step up in terms of influencing the culture and social lives. She says that they have a fundamental responsibility to do more.
The content that digital platforms service through algorithms and recommender systems, particularly to young Australians, has an impact in reinforcing harmful and outdated gender norms. While digital platforms may not be creating the content themselves, they play a major role in determining much of what people see.
That's the Communications Minister Michelle Rowland there, and before her, our reporter Evelyn Manfield in Canberra. So how do we change behaviour and attitudes to family and domestic violence? Australia has long been seen as a world leader when it comes to some of its public health campaigns, which help to save thousands of lives from drink driving to skin cancer, HIV/AIDS and smoking.
Every cigarette is doing you damage.
At first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS.
Shooting up drugs is like playing Russian roulette. Go on.
I don't know.
So if you drink, then drive.
I really didn't drink that much.
You're a bloody idiot.
Urban Turp, it's a random breath test. I'll just get you to blow.
So could some of the same methods be used to change behaviour in domestic violence and also highlight support to survivors? In a moment, you'll hear from Professor Bill Botell, who was pivotal in the effort to combat AIDS in Australia. But first, Professor Terry Slevin is the CEO of the Public Health Association of Australia.
There certainly is a prospect of being able to do that, and there's been attempts already to go down that path. But all the campaigns that you mention have other components to achieve the success. Best campaigns make us feel something, whether it's disgust, you know, the tar coming out of the squeezed lung, whether it's anxiety at being caught drink driving. Those emotional responses are things that really shift us, but they also are only one part of the puzzle. In relation to the examples that I've given, I mean, we generate anxiety by an ad on TV that thinks we might get caught for drink driving. It also is going to be important that people see booze buses and that the penalties that apply if you are caught are significant, for example, in the potential perpetrator with regard to domestic violence. It also needs proper enforcement of apprehended violence orders, for example, and significant penalties for people who breach them. So the kind of things around the issue need to reinforce the messages the campaign send.
What about almost instructional ads saying to potential perpetrators of domestic violence, if you end up in this kind of situation and you're feeling anger and frustration rising, here's what you do and here's what you don't do in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, there are a type of campaign that people will be familiar with that we'd call behavioural modelling, and that is we demonstrate the behaviour we want people to follow. But, Sally, one of the important parts of running these campaigns is they're not a magic wand. They don't fix the problem immediately, and rarely does one campaign by itself shift the dial. What they need to be is consistent, and we think about, you know, over 20, 30 or more years, the tobacco campaigns that we've seen come and go, similarly Slip, Stop, Snap and other areas that you mentioned, they keep on turning up. They keep on moving the issue along. They take a different aspect because a single message is rarely influential with everybody, but they can also be high reward in shifting the attitudes that you're trying to influence and sometimes influencing the behaviour.
That's Professor Terry Slevin there, CEO of the Public Health Association of Australia. Well, Professor Bill Botell played a leadership role, a vital role in Australia's successful campaign against HIV/AIDS. He says in public health efforts, words must be backed up with long-term support.
Of course, there is a scope for a campaign to do that. What shouldn't be the case is just a campaign with no organisation and thought behind it. That is very counterproductive. A campaign to be effective has to really talk to and address the people who are most at risk of domestic violence, so that those who feel threatened or their families know where to turn to and what action can be taken. The lesson of the HIV campaign was that when we put it all together and we were very successful in getting people to change behaviours that put them at risk, we spent 2 or 3 years getting everything right. There were hotlines, there was the information, there was the tools that you needed to change behaviour and to sustain that behaviour change. I don't quite see that at the moment in relation to a domestic violence situation.
What did the AIDS campaign teach you about how you get to that tipping point of changing behaviour? It's one thing to get a message out there, but it's another thing to change norms and behaviours and beliefs.
It taught me the need to base the campaign in the communities that you're dealing with. And the promise of a campaign delivered by governments is that if you come to us to ask for that help and assistance, something will happen. Not just thoughts and prayers, but something will happen.
That's Professor Bill Botell there. New South Wales is launching a major awareness campaign today targeting coercive control. Analysis undertaken by the state found that almost all intimate partner domestic violence homicides were preceded by psychological abuse. The campaign is designed to educate people before laws criminalising coercive control take effect in July. Kathleen Ferguson reports.
when they need to know everything about you, who you're with, and where you are. It's not love. It's coercive control.
New South Wales is the first state to criminalise coercive control. Now it's launching an ad campaign to educate people about this abusive behaviour. Dr. Bridget Mottram is a senior policy officer with Domestic Violence New South Wales. She says coercive control is insidious and can be hard to spot.
Coercive control is this unbelievable web of coercion, and it's really trying to completely control a person, mind, body and soul. And, you know, we hear a lot about physical violence, but it's the emotional and psychological impact of coercive control where they're just so dependent upon the perpetrator, but also so confused.
She says it's up to everyone to learn more about it.
Domestic violence is everyone's responsibility, and it's everybody's responsibility to make sure that they're educating themselves on things like coercive control.
A state government review found coercive control was evident in almost all instances of intimate partner homicides in New South Wales. Jodie Harrison is the state's Minister for the Prevention of Domestic and Sexual Violence.
The Domestic Violence Death Review team, through their analysis of deaths between the year 2000 and 2018, found that about 97% of intimate partner domestic violence homicides were preceded by the perpetrator using emotional and psychological abuse as a form of coercive control towards the victim.
And from July this year, it will become a criminal offence in New South Wales, with Queensland to follow in 2025. If someone is found guilty, they could face up to 7 years in prison. The New South Wales government says it's also looking at other measures to address the domestic violence crisis. It's currently reviewing bail laws after the alleged murder of 28-year-old childcare worker Molly Ticehurst in the town of Forbes in the state's central west. Her ex-partner has been charged. He was on bail for alleged violent offences against her. Jacinda Atchison is a spokesperson for the Ticehurst family.
The judicial system let Molly down. The victim support teams let Molly down. In Molly's case, the police did everything they could to keep Molly safe. There has to be something put into place that says, if you receive bail today, we will know where you are the minute that you walk out of here.
The family wants tougher bail laws, which include measures like closer monitoring. Molly's loved ones want this legislation named after her.
The monitoring devices need to be put into place, and it needs to become Molly's law.
Her family and friends are also asking Australians to pay a special tribute to Molly today by leaving their front lights on.
Leave your light on for Molly. If things happen in the dark, leave the light on for Molly.
And for those wanting to help further, there's a call out to donate old working mobile phones to a charity helping women fleeing domestic violence. Former police officer Janine Fulton is the spokeswoman for the charity DV Safephone. She says new phones are donated and set up safely to avoid women being tracked by their abusers.
Regardless of the condition of it, so long as it can be used, then please, we would love to receive your phones, because it does change lives.
Details about where to donate phones can be found on the website dvsafephone.org.
That's Kathleen Ferguson with additional reporting from Joanna Woodburn. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, you can call 000. You're listening into The World Today. When Australia's intelligence organisation catches foreign spies trying to steal defence and security secrets, you'd think it'd be worth celebrating. But it's a difficult tightrope to walk when the spies are working for a crucial defence partner. The Washington Post has revealed that at least two Indian spies were expelled from Australia in 2020, and ASIO chose not to reveal their identities. Angus Randall reports.
3 years ago, ASIO head Mike Burgess announced his organisation had broken up a foreign spy ring.
ASIO acted. We confronted the foreign spies and quietly and professionally removed them from our country. And I'm not going to name who it was.
We now know they were spying for India, thanks to an investigation from the Washington Post, confirmed by the ABC. Greg Miller is the newspaper's international investigative correspondent.
They were
cultivating sources within police departments, trying to gather information on sensitive security arrangements at airports. They were monitoring the Indian Sikh population in Australia, and it became quite a serious thing.
At the time, Mike Burgess said revealing the country behind the spy ring would serve as an unnecessary distraction. Greg Miller can understand why the government wanted to avoid a stoush with India.
Despite taking this tough action, it looks like Australia as well tried to sort of contain the fallout here.
This morning, Treasurer Jim Chalmers remained reluctant to criticise India. He says both countries have a good relationship and he's not interested in commenting further.
I don't really propose to get into those stories that we've seen on the ABC in the last day or two. I think the heads of our intelligence agencies, they make information available in a very deliberate way.
Deputy Opposition Leader Susan Lee is striking a similar note of caution.
I've just seen that report, and with something so sensitive as national security, I'm not going to make free-willing comments or freelance on that. We need to look further at the detail.
Australia has been part of a security group alongside India, Japan and the United States called the Quad since 2017. It's viewed as a response to China's rise in the Pacific. Dr. Ian Hall is from Griffith University. He says Australia's secrecy around the Indian spy ring shows both countries want to move on.
In terms of the Australia-India relationship is increasingly important. It's only going to grow in importance. And so whilst these things are unfortunate and they might be seen as a little bit unfriendly, these things do kind of happen.
The revelations come as more than 1 billion Indians head to the polls. The election began 2 weeks ago and voting won't be complete until June. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to win another 5-year term. Priya Chacko is an Associate Professor of International Politics at the University of Adelaide. She says Narendra Modi is trying to control overseas Indian communities.
There's been an increasing trend in Indian foreign policy toward the use of transnational repression against diaspora groups that are seen as dissidents and as a threat to Narendra Modi's government. This has been happening since he was elected in 2014, but it's ramped up since 2019 when the government became increasingly repressive and authoritarian.
India's spy agency has been linked to the assassination of a Sikh activist in Canada, and the US government says it thwarted the attempted killing of an Indian activist living in the US. The Indian government denies any connection to the assassination plots. Associate Professor Priya Chacko says India's Western allies need to protect their Sikh communities.
We also need to publicly acknowledge that India is doing these things and to put a spotlight on that type of behaviour and to call it out.
ASIO, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and the Indian High Commission in Canberra declined to comment on the story.
That's Angus Randall. And for more on politics in India, you can listen to the ABC podcast Looking for Modi. It's available now on the ABC Listen app. The Queensland government is overhauling sentencing laws for young offenders as anger continues to build among victims of crime. With an election looming, the Premier, Stephen Miles, is promising a $1.3 billion crackdown, including hundreds more police. The response also includes changing the language in sentencing laws to state that a child should be detained in custody where necessary to ensure community safety. Stephanie Smale reports.
Victims of crime have been voicing their anger outside Queensland's Parliament for months, sharing stories about the sometimes deadly impact of youth crime. After another day of protests, Queensland's Premier Stephen Miles has revealed he'll remove sentencing as a last resort for young offenders.
To make it really clear to the public and to the courts that they need to detain offenders where that is necessary to keep the community safe. That's what Queenslanders have told me they expect and they want to see.
The new wording states a child should be detained in custody where necessary to ensure community safety, where other measures wouldn't be sufficient. Stephen Miles says the existing wording, that a child should only be detained as a last resort, was undermining public confidence in the law and the court system.
Community safety must be the first consideration. We need intervention and prevention where that will work, but where it is necessary to detain an offender to keep the community safe, we're going to write into the law that that must be done.
The Queensland government is already facing legal action by youth advocates for breaching its own human rights laws by keeping children in adult watch houses. But the state government is persisting with its crackdown, releasing the Queensland government's so-called community safety plan this week. It includes a dramatic expansion of police search powers and hundreds of extra police. Child safety advocates argue the $1.3 billion plan won't stop youth crime in Queensland.
This is a plan that includes 36 pages, predominantly of photos of police, with big investments into police services, but no investment in actually the early intervention and prevention that's going to stop crime occurring.
Tom Allsop is the CEO of the child protection body Peak Care Queensland. He argues the changes to sentencing language won't change the status quo.
Queensland doesn't have a problem sentencing and detaining young people. We lead the nation.
Premier Stephen Miles has been critical of sentencing crackdowns in the past, labelling mandatory detention and mandatory minimum sentencing policies as incredibly dangerous, saying they would harden children and make them more likely to re-offend. Peak Care Queensland CEO Tom Allsop points out, despite years of lobbying and evidence-based argument, prevention and intervention efforts are still lagging. He acknowledges long-term measures to support young offenders aren't politically appealing, but they must be considered.
And it's a really, really tough environment and a really tough year to be asking for that. But we need our politicians to be raising the bar.
Victims of crime support groups have welcomed the change to sentencing laws, but they're concerned there's not enough capacity in detention centres. They're also calling for better rehabilitation for young offenders who are in custody.
That's Stephanie Smale. Well, sport is often seen as a crucial way of boosting mental health resilience, especially among young people. But in some regional areas, finding a club can be difficult and it often involves extra costs and long distances of travel. For the past few weeks, a squad of tennis coaches has been bringing the love of the game to communities in outback New South Wales to help improve the mental health of local youth. It's called Rally Forever, and reporter Catherine James went along to find out more.
I want some inspiration. Come on, let's go, Ningen.
It's a weeknight in far west New South Wales, and former tennis pro Louise Fleming is rallying with 60 kids and their parents on newly laid tennis courts in Ningen.
Ready? Oh, I like it.
Her not-for-profit program, Rally Forever, is already in 24 locations across eastern parts of the state. Now she's taking it west.
Social connection is really important for mental well-being. It is the number one thing. We can work with people that are a little bit low mood or they might be feeling loneliness, and I think social isolation out here in the country is, you know, it's happening in the big cities and it happens in the small country towns too.
Youth worker Tara Brookman works in Ningen with homeless children between the ages of 12 and 15.
There is a lot, yeah, especially out this way. Like,
no worries.
Like drug and alcohol is a massive thing out here. I had a couple kids that I worked with here tonight, so yeah, it was so good to see them starting to get involved.
She says the area is desperate for more programs like Rally Forever.
It's more of a need out here. A lot of kids struggle to get access to support systems and networks and everything else. Like it's very disadvantaged out this way.
We might be able to help with that. We've got a mental health nurse that it's a coach for Rally Forever, and she's very keen to come out here and support, so that could be something.
It's conversations like these Louise Fleming has had many times in recent days. Over the last 2 weeks, her team has visited 11 towns across the west and north of the state.
But it is just listening to everyone, the conversations we've been having, it just goes so much deeper.
But the first rule is to have fun.
For Ningen, this has just blown my mind. Like, it's so good to have professionals, enthusiastic, passionate, with the best intentions.
That's Denise O'Malley, a mum who's travelled here with her children from the tiny town of Hermadale, 45 kilometres away.
Yeah, it's just totally exceeded all expectations this evening. I was coming in for the kids to have a look, and I'm in my thongs and I've had the best fun ever.
Her 3-year-old daughter, Neve, was also on the court.
I'm good at serving nicely.
Good at both?
Yeah.
Those here tonight know more work is needed to improve youth mental health services in the regions. But for people like Denise O'Malley, Rally Forever is an important step in the right direction.
It's a great thing in every respect, from mental health to socially connecting and community and fun and coordination, and you're exercising and without even feeling like you're breaking a sweat, you're just having that much fun. So yeah, it's great.
That's Hermitdale mother Denise O'Malley ending that report from Catherine James. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Things were meant to be getting better and easier. But now one prominent economist is predicting interest rates will go up 3 times this year. What a turnaround. A nanosecond ago, we were being told rates were likely to start falling soon. Today, Chief Business Correspondent Ian Verinder explains what's going wrong. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.